Well, it's so lovely to see all your smiling faces, and I hope you're enjoying dinner. A nice glass of wine. I haven't partaken of a wine. I felt that that probably wasn't wise since I was going to speak, but I'm glad to see all of you enjoying yourselves, and it's really nice to be here in person. So thank you, Stephen, for that introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you all this evening. I think I inherited this from the previous Deputy Governor. I believe there's a bit of a tradition of Governor, Deputy Governor giving these speeches, and I inherited this from Guy, but it's a pleasure to be here. So our statement on monetary policy was published last Friday, I think you probably would all know, and so I'd like to talk about our current outlook for the Australian economy. I think as many of you would understand from first-hand experience, forecasting is always difficult, but especially so over the last couple of years. Nevertheless, as I noted in a speech last month, forecasting is an important part of our monetary policy process, since the Reserve Bank Board does need to form a view on how its policy decisions might impact the economy and inflation in the future. So what I'm going to do is start with a little bit of a look back at where our forecast stood in August, and then I'll highlight the areas where subsequent developments have impacted the forecasts. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the ways we review our forecasts and about the main uncertainties around the current forecasts and how they impact our thinking on monetary policy. One thing I would like to emphasise right up front is that the Board's priority is to return inflation to the 2-3% band over time. Price stability is a prerequisite for a strong economy and a sustained period of full employment. And this is what has driven our policy decisions to date. And it's expected that further increases in interest rates will be required to meet this objective. I think we've said a number of times, though, the size and timing of the future increases will depend on the data. So first of all, I want to set the scene for where we were 3 months ago. Think back, internationally, inflation was at multi-decades high in many countries. And although energy was a large part of this, there was also broad-based price pressures from strong demand, meeting supply constraints for both labour and goods. As a result, central banks were increasing interest rates very quickly. And while global demand was holding up, the twin pressures of declining real wages and interest rate rises were expected to put pressure on households and businesses. Forecasts for global growth were therefore being revised down through this period. For China, the COVID-19 containment policy and issues in the real estate sector were viewed as being negative for growth as well. And given China's importance as a trading partner, this would have implications for Australia. At the same time, back in August, Australian economic activity was holding up well. Consumption of services that had been curtailed during COVID-19 outbreaks early in 2022 had rebounded, and goods consumption at the same time was holding up. The labour market was tight, and this was supporting household incomes. At the same time, inflation was at multi-decade highs and interest rates were rising. And while this was impacting on consumer confidence, we were yet to see much of an impact on consumer spending. And business confidence actually was quite high. So higher consumer prices, rising interest rates, and falling housing prices were all expected to increasingly weigh on consumption, although we hadn't seen it happen yet. So in this environment, back in August, our forecasts were for growth to slow in 2023. And in line with this, we were forecasting the unemployment rate to gradually increase over the forecast period. Inflation was forecast to peak at 7.75% at the end of 2022, before gradually moving back to the top of the target band by the end of 2024. Now, since then, there's been a number of developments that have led us to revise our forecasts, although the extent of the revisions have been reasonably modest compared with the experience of recent years, where the revisions at some times were very large. So on the international front, firstly, the prospects of a significant slowing in the global economy have intensified, and this reflects a number of factors. First of all, inflation has stayed persistently high, and that's resulted in an upward revision of outlook for policy rates in a number of advanced economies. There has already been a fast and simultaneous rise in policy rates, and many central banks have indicated that they will do what it takes to get inflation back down to their targets. The energy crisis in Europe has also led to a further downgrade in growth in the euro area and the United Kingdom. Expectations for growth in advanced economies are therefore a bit weaker than 3 months ago and much weaker than was the case last year. And finally, the outlook for China has been downgraded. Overall growth in Australia's trading partners is expected to be slightly below 3.5% in 2022 and 23, well below its pre-pandemic decade average of 4.5%. So I turn to the domestic economy now. The recent flooding in southeastern Australia has been disastrous for many households and businesses. The Murray-Darling Basin received a record volume of rain in October, following well above average rainfall earlier in the year, and you can see from this chart that it's accelerated recently. The full extent of crop and livestock losses is still being assessed, and there is more damage as flooding progresses along river systems. The areas flooded in New South Wales, Tasmania and Victoria in October, together they account for a substantial proportion of agricultural output. The affected products include winter cereal crops, fruit and vegetables and dairy. Encouragingly, our contacts in the Bank's liaison program have noted that not all crops in affected areas will have been destroyed. While there's been substantial effects on flood impacted communities with significant disruption and damage, the effect of the floods is likely to be less evident in economy-wide activity. However, prices for some food products are likely to be temporarily higher. Furthermore, with above average rainfall expected over coming months, consistent with the ongoing La Nina event, there is also an increased likelihood of further supply disruptions affecting costs and prices for a range of goods in 2022 and early 2023. A second material development for the domestic economy has been the revised outlook for energy prices. Retail prices of electricity and gas have increased by 10 to 15% since the middle of the year, and much of this effect is still to come through in the December quarter CPI. This is consistent with our expectations a few months ago. But since then, we've learned that larger electricity and gas price increases than previously assumed are now likely in 2023. Finally, there are indicators suggesting that wages growth is a bit stronger than we had thought 3 months ago. In liaison, firms in most industries have reported higher than average wages growth. Since the middle of the year, close to half the firms have reported realised wage increases of 3 to 5%, with a further quarter of firms reporting increases above 5%. New and timely data on wages outcomes for enterprise agreements from the Fair Work Commission shows that average wage increases in newly lodged enterprise agreements were a touch stronger in the September quarter compared with approved agreements in the June quarter. Despite a stronger pickup, aggregate wages growth remains moderate so far, and wage growth expectations generally remain consistent with the inflation target. But given these developments, we now expect inflation to be a little higher than our August forecasts. At the same time, though, we've lowered our forecasts for growth and employment. So you can see here from this graph, we now expect headline inflation to peak at around 8% at the end of 2022, a little bit higher than earlier forecast and coming down a little slower. Larger than expected increases in food prices are part of the story, but it's also the case that underlying inflationary pressures have been a little stronger than we previously thought. Faster rates of price inflation have spread beyond consumer durables and the prices of newly constructed homes to items such as groceries and market services in recent quarters. Grocery inflation has been elevated, and this is expected to be sustained in the near term as a consequence of the floods and as rising costs of suppliers continue to be passed through to prices in supermarkets. The broad-based nature of the price pressures are evident in the share of CPI items that are rising at an annualised rate of more than 3%. That's around about 70-75%, as you can see in this chart. This share is the highest it's been in a number of decades, And the last time it was close to this was in 2008. It still wasn't up there. Inflation was well above target at that time, and the bank was increasing the policy rate. So while inflation forecasts have been revised up a little, there are good reasons to think that we are approaching the peak of inflation this cycle. Much of the initial surge in grain prices in reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine has reversed. The global imbalance between supply and demand for goods continues to be resolved. Higher interest rates globally are helping to moderate demand pressures. But supply delivery times have shortened, backlogs of work have declined, and inventories have recovered mostly to more normal levels. And you can see from this graph that some of the supply indicators we monitor are coming down quite quickly. Along with lower oil prices, this has contributed to a decline in shipping costs and a moderation in input costs more generally. Domestic price pressures are also playing a role in the current period of high inflation. The outlook for domestic energy prices and rents are two areas we are monitoring closely. The large increases in retail gas and electricity prices are predicted for next year to directly add over 1 percentage point to headline inflation over the year to September 2023. And because energy is an input to many of the goods and services we buy, there will also be second round effects to businesses as businesses increase their prices in response. These effects are uncertain, but the second round contribution of electricity prices to underlying inflation could be around 0.5 percentage point over 2024. Now, rental price inflation has also picked up, and it's expected to increase further over coming quarters. Rental vacancy rates have declined since the beginning of the year and are at historic lows in a number of cities. Growth in advertised rents for new leases has been very strong as a result. Now, this will continue to flow through to the CPI measure of rent inflation, which measures rent increases for all leases, and that'll happen over coming quarters. Close to one third of Australian households rent, and many of these households have relatively low income and wealth. So higher rents could push some renters into financial stress, particularly when combined with broader cost of living pressures. The Australian economy appears to have grown solidly over the second half of 2022, as household spending on services remains firm, alongside a further pickup in education and travel services exports. GDP growth is then expected to slow in early 2023. We've got it coming off as the recovery in household spending from pandemic-related restrictions is expected then to have mostly run its course. Consumer spending has been supported by past gains in incomes, asset prices, and accumulated savings during the pandemic. However, these sources of support are being eroded to some extent by high inflation, rising interest rates and falling housing prices, and this is expected to contribute to a slowing in consumption growth from early next year. Demand for labour remains strong, but employment growth has been modest recently, suggesting that limited spare capacity remains in the labour market. The unemployment rate is forecast to remain around 3.5% until mid-2023, before rising to 4.25% by the end of 2024 as economic growth slows. Broader measures of labour underutilisation that include workers who are underemployed are also expected to remain around their lowest levels in many years in the near term. It's worth emphasising, I think, that the positives that a strong labour market conditions will continue to deliver for all Australians. Even with the modest increase in unemployment that we forecast to occur as the economy slows, the unemployment rate will still be close to its lowest level in decades. A higher share of Australians have a job than ever before. Total labour force participation is very high, but female labour force participation is near record high, and there are opportunities for young Australians to gain employment. These are all positive things. Now, before I talk about some of the uncertainties of the outlook, I want to take a few minutes to talk about how we review our forecasts. So I'm not saying anything you don't know, but forecasting is difficult at the best of times. It's unlikely, very unlikely, that GDP growth, unemployment or inflation will exactly match point forecasts. And as the past few years demonstrates, it's often a question more of how wrong we will be with the forecast. Now, this could be because of unforeseen shocks that hit the economy or households and businesses might behave differently to what we're expecting them to behave. So although we publish updated forecasts once a quarter, we in fact keep a very close eye on how our forecasts are going through the quarter by closely analysing incoming data and information from our own business liaison to see if the economy is evolving as expected. We also review past forecast errors. So each year, a review of the accuracy of the bank's economic forecast is presented to the board to assess what we've learned about the economy and our forecasting approach over the previous year. The annual review draws on a wide range of inputs, such as new econometric models and forecast techniques, forecast accuracy for specific variables, and alternative sources of information. And some of you may have noticed that in the November statement on monetary policy, we summarised some of the findings from this year's forecast review, focusing in particular on where our inflation forecasts didn't do so well. We also look at forecasts from other sources as a way to review our thinking. So we compare a bank forecast with those of other economic forecasters regularly, including many of you in this room. This process includes regular discussions with government agencies, reviews of available forecasts, and quarterly surveys of private sector economists. These comparisons provide alternative interpretations of the outlook, they challenge our own thinking, and they provide a benchmark to assess our accuracy. So, for example, this shows our forecasts in the green bars along with some forecasts among private sector economists. You can see here, for example, that the average forecast for GDP growth among private sector economists is similar to the bank's outlook for 2023, but inflation is anticipated by many to decline a little faster than we're expecting. These forecast comparisons, we complement these with panel discussions with academics, and many of these same economists, panel discussions, where specific issues we can examine a bit more closely in these discussions. Now, a key part of the forecasting process is thinking about the risks and uncertainties around the central forecast and the way things could turn out a little bit differently. Each quarter when we publish our forecasts, we discuss a range of uncertainties that explore how the economy might respond under conditions that vary from the central case. And this helps us to identify events that could have a meaningful effect on the economy and policy. The uncertainties around the central forecasts are particularly elevated at the moment. The statement we highlight four: the international environment, wage and price setting behaviour, household consumption, and energy and supply shocks. I talked a little about the international situation earlier. While forecasts of global growth have been revised down, the risks are still to the downside, we think. A significant concern from our perspective is downside risks in China. The authorities' approach to suppressing COVID-19 increases the risk of major lockdowns periodically impacting production and consumption. Stress in the property market, one of the engines of Chinese growth in the past, also carries the possibility of a significant downturn in activity. Residential property sales in China have declined sharply over the past year, and housing starts have also fallen to be lower than they've been for a decade. Property developers are in stress, and many are finding it difficult to finance the construction of apartments that they have committed to. The government is encouraging banks to lend and is supplying some direct support, but at the same time, it's been encouraging developers to reduce their indebtedness. So this weakness in the property sector has implications for steel demand and hence demand for our iron ore. The second area of substantial uncertainty is what the current high inflation and cost of living pressures might do to wage and price expectations in Australia. Every day in the news, we hear about how price rises are hurting households. First, it was rises in the prices of goods during the pandemic, as supply chains couldn't cope with the surge in demand. But increasingly, price rises in non-discretionary goods are impacting household budgets. Petrol, then groceries, now rent and electricity. The floods have resulted in volatility in fresh food prices. Furthermore, high fuel and shipping costs are finding their way into prices as businesses pass on increases in their input costs. So how households and businesses respond to these pressures is going to be critical for the Australian economy and the path of monetary policy. Households recognise that their real wages are declining. And with the labour market as tight as it is, it's quite possible that workers will demand and may get wage rises. Businesses might well be willing to pay higher wages if they think they can easily pass on the cost in higher prices. How this inflation psychology plays out is critical for the inflation outlook and for monetary policy, because if this mindset were to take hold, inflation will remain high. The third uncertainty is the behaviour of households as interest rates and inflation rise. Although household debt hasn't risen much over the past decade relative to income, it is still high. So rising interest rates could make servicing debt much harder. On the other hand, one of the legacies of the pandemic was a large build-up in household savings buffers. With fiscal support for incomes during the pandemic, low interest rates increased the cash flow of households with mortgages and at times limited opportunities to spend, and savings increased markedly over the past couple of years. We estimate that households overall accumulated more than $250 billion in additional savings during the pandemic. Most of this saving, it's true to say, has been among households at the upper end of the income distribution, reflecting in part the constraints on consumption of discretionary services. So while households on lower incomes with lower buffers are likely to cut back on consumption, some households could draw down their savings to support consumption in the face of rising interest rates and cost of living pressures. Furthermore, the response of household consumption to falling housing prices is uncertain. We know consumption typically weakens as asset prices and particularly housing prices decline, but the magnitude is difficult to forecast. And despite recent falls, it's worth remembering that housing prices still remain substantially above their level prior to the pandemic. Now, the final uncertainty is around energy and other supply shocks that could boost inflation and lower growth. The situation in Europe remains very uncertain. While gas prices have declined lately, they are expected to rise again, particularly if there's an unusually cold winter or if Russia's war on Ukraine escalates further. Higher global energy prices can help our export earnings, but they could also put upward pressure on electricity prices in Australia, adding to inflationary pressures. We have built a large increase in electricity prices into our central scenario for inflation, but there is a risk we haven't incorporated enough. On the other side of the coin, however, we have seen that global supply chain pressures are easing, and they could ease quite quickly, more quickly than we're expecting, and that could turn out to be a more dampening force than we're currently expecting. So in conclusion, I would say that the Australian economy has come out of the pandemic in a strong position, but inflation is still too high. It's increasingly broad-based, and our central forecast is that it won't peak until the end of the year. After that, we expect rising interest rates and cost of living pressures to drive a moderation in consumption that brings demand more in line with supply. This should help to get inflation back down to our target over the next couple of years. But forecasting is inherently difficult, particularly when there are so many unusual forces bearing on the outlook. There are many uncertainties about the behaviour of households and businesses, as well as the potential for unforeseen shocks. And that's why it's important we're continually reviewing the incoming data and testing the forecasts. So I thank you for your interest and your attention, and I look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. A very engaging and insightful speech. So as Michelle implied just then, she's agreed to take some questions from the floor. So please state your name and affiliation when you ask a question. And please don't make any speeches. Michelle's just made a speech. We don't need any more. So please, just a question. And we'll start out with Tavis. Thanks.
Cheers, thank you. Tavis Strickland from National Australia Bank. I think I speak for many of my fellow economists in this room and maybe for some businesses as well. Very confused about the latest SOMP. You have inflation a little above 3% in 2024, implying that inflation doesn't get back to target until 2025. How should we as economists and businesses interpret this? And is there any implication in terms of the RBA's inflation target, how happy it is to have inflation above 3%? And specifically, this is in relation to Governor Lowe's comments back in 2014 to 2016, when he was saying he was happy that inflation or inflation expectations were that people were thinking inflation was going to be 2% or had a 2 handle. And a lot of people interpreted that as actually decreasing inflation expectations during that period. Should we interpret this as saying the RBA is happy with inflation at 3 or 3% plus? Thank you.
I wouldn't necessarily interpret it that way. Our target band is 2 to 3%, but the over time is the critical qualifier on the end. What I think we are trying to achieve here is a slowdown in the economy, which is sufficient to bring inflation back down to that. It's not quite there in the forecast period, but if we went a bit further out, we're expecting that it will come back down within target. It's just not within the forecast horizon that we've currently published. We've made some really big gains in terms of employment in the Australian economy, and if we crunch, we could crunch the economy very hard and bring inflation down very quickly, but we might lose, we would very likely lose those gains. So I know the Governor's talked about the narrow path. What we are trying to achieve here is keep those gains in employment that we have achieved. The unemployment rate will have to rise. The economy does have to slow. But we think that we can hopefully bring the inflation rate back down to that target band. It might take a little bit longer, but we can preserve some of those gains for employment that we've achieved over the last few years. So that I think is the key.
Thank you.
Richard.
Thanks, Richard Yetsenga from ANZ. Thanks, Michelle. Yes, I'm over here. I just wanted to follow up the discussion of the labour market. I think coming into this period of inflation, the Governor had outlined a framework where really wages was the key transmission mechanism through to inflation, and it doesn't seem to have been that way this time. And in fact, despite labour market conditions being exceptionally tight, we don't actually have a particularly meaningful pickup in rates of pay at all. What are your thoughts about what that implies, what you think about inflation and the wage generation process in Australia? Is there something a bit broken?
I wouldn't say broken. First point I'd make is that we are still watching wages quite closely. There are signs that wages growth is picking up. And I think we've made the point in the past that prior to the pandemic, wages growth was actually too low to generate inflation in the target band. If you think about the, say, 2.5% on average over time for inflation, if you think productivity of 1%, then you should be able to sustain wages growth of 3.5%. What's happening at the moment, I think, is one of the big uncertainties that I referred to. In some other countries, we are observing wages responding very quickly to tight labour markets. We're seeing that in the US, we're seeing that in New Zealand, we're seeing it in the UK. One difference that is we've noticed with Australia is that our labour supply has responded, whereas at least in those countries, their participation rates are actually still lower than they were prior to the pandemic. So one thing that's suggesting is that our supply has been more flexible than theirs and we haven't had the outflows from the labour force. The other possibility is that our particular wage setting arrangements, in particular EBAs with, you know, a number of years setting, have actually delayed the pass-through of these sorts of things. So if you're a little more pessimistic or optimistic, depending on who you are in terms of wage rises, it might be that as those things start to roll over, that wage rises start to come through there. But one thing I think I would say is that there does seem to be a recognition or an acceptance that this period of inflation is temporary. Financial market expectations of inflation remain pretty well anchored in the medium term. And anecdotally, even a lot of the wage decisions we're seeing, the EBAs and so on, they're not coming in dramatically above. They're putting in higher claims, but they're settling for something a little bit lower. So some increase in wage rises, I think, is important. But at the moment, we're not seeing the same pressures from overseas, and I think that's positive for the inflation outlook. But we still need wage rises of the order of 3.5% to sustain inflation in the band.
Thanks for your speech, Michelle, and particularly thanks for talking through some of the processes that the bank goes through, both tonight and in your speech the other day. Joe Masters from Barrenjoey. I just wanted to pick up on your comment about the importance of inflation psychology. So it feels to me that we have reasonable measures around consumer expectations, trade union expectations, the people in this room, but we don't get a lot of data or information around the business side of that inflation psychology. So I'm interested in terms of your business liaison. What are businesses telling you about the number that are passing on price increases, or the amount that's being passed on, and in fact how they think about the wage pressure and the energy bills that are coming for businesses as well as households in terms of their pricing going forward over the next year?
Yeah, thanks, Jo. We are hearing from our business liaison that businesses are, A, finding input cost pressures and wage pressures affecting them. We are also hearing that they are more willing than in the past to look at passing these prices on. I know that big companies like Coles and Woolworths have explicitly said that they're willing now to consider suppliers' requests for increased prices. And so I think there are signs that is, and that's partly what is driving us to make sure that we get the signal out there, or the message out there, that we will do what it takes. We don't want one-off price increases to generate a cycle where, well, that's now the norm, we'll do that again next year. There's a difference between a one-off level shift and a continual shift, which increases by more and more each year. So we are hearing that from businesses. That is partly what is driving our messaging, to make sure that we get this message across that, yes, we understand that there's one-off price increases, but this doesn't have to embed itself in the inflationary impetus in the country.
We've got a Rob and then Sarah.
Rob Henderson, independent economist. Yes, thanks. Fantastic presentation. You spoke about some of the uncertainties looking ahead concerning the potential for a wage price spiral, and you were addressing that in your answer to Joe's question there. And you did mention the supermarkets, I noticed. Isn't it true that if you look at the ABS's preferred measure, and I think this comes from an RBA paper published a while back, that capital share of national income is now at historic highs? So doesn't that basically mean that profit margins are at historic highs? So shouldn't that mean that with enough competition in the economy that we should be in a position where wages can rise and wages share of national income could go up without any need for price increases? Does this whole debate basically... is it about the fact that we don't have enough competition in our economy anymore? And it's interesting you shouldn't bring the supermarkets up in the answer to your last question in that context.
No, I don't think there's any evidence that there's margins of what's driving this. I think the data show that if you take the mining companies out, the profit share actually hasn't increased that much at all. There's a very large chunk of mining in there. So, by definition, profit share goes up, wages share goes down, but if you take the mining companies out, actually, it doesn't. In recent years, it doesn't look as stark. There's been a more longer-term trend in that respect, but the recent rise that people are talking about doesn't look as obvious. I don't believe that is what's driving things. I think if you look at what small businesses in particular are telling us. They're still telling us that it's very competitive out there. So, and small businesses are, interestingly, I think what's driving a lot of the expenditure at the moment. The consumption is all in these services and the non-discretionary expenditure in which the small business community is really heavily involved. And I think competition is alive and well there. So I don't think it's a margin. I don't think it's a margin story.
Michelle, thank you very much for your speech. I'm Sarah Hunter from KPMG. I was thinking a bit about the risks around the forecast as well, and I wanted to ask you about migration, which I don't think you mentioned, but just looking at some of the latest data, both on the long-term arrivals and the visa processing that's going through the system, it looks as though we are going to get a significantly faster recovery than perhaps we were all anticipating 3-6 months ago. It'd be really great to hear what the bank sees and thinks about that in the context of both the labour market, but also demand conditions in the local economy.
Sure. I think we heard a lot about during the pandemic and the labour shortages about immigration might be the solution to this. The challenge, of course, and you know, you would all know this, the challenge, of course, is that migrants also bring demand with them, as you alluded to. They come in, they want to go to restaurants and buy clothes and buy food and so on. So it's not a simple solution just to say the tight labour market. It's true that there are some particular pockets of labour shortages, and the classic ones are agriculture and hospitality, where the lack of backpackers and so on has generated particular problems for those industries. But an overall immigration increase doesn't necessarily solve the supply-demand problem completely, because it generates both. So what comes out on top, I don't really know. But as I said, there's certain pockets it will relieve labour tightness in, but the overall effect, it could be marginal in terms of effect on the labour market.
Good evening. Deputy Governor Bullock.
You can call me Michelle, Rory, it's right. Okay. You know me better than that.
Michelle, I keep reading the newspapers, opinion pieces by academic economists that stating basically that monetary policy would be much better formulated in Australia if there was a greater intellectual contribution from academic economists. Mm-hmm. There's a review underway at present. Has the Reserve Bank of Australia made a submission to the review panel? And if so, did it argue that if only the Reserve Bank board could have more academic economists on it, that might be the silver bullet for better forecasting and better policy outcomes from the Reserve Bank?
Well, that's actually a fairly simple answer. No, we haven't made a submission to the review committee, Rory, and we'll leave the review panel to decide how they want to handle that particular issue.
Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for your presentation before. It's Christian Colding from Oxford Economics. I want to touch on maybe an extension to Joe Master's question earlier about inflation expectations, and I note that you're talking about inflation expectations as a risk to the outlook, but not quite the baseline. Now, inflation expectations seems to have been well anchored in Australia, which is a great outcome. Hasn't been so well anchored overseas in comparable economies. So I'd love to know a little bit about why do you think we've been able to anchor inflation expectations as well as we have in Australia relative to some of the comparable economies out there?
I wouldn't say, well, it depends on whose expectations you're talking about, I think. Financial market expectations overseas in the medium term, their expectations have remained reasonably well anchored. If you want to equate wage rises with inflationary expectations in some of these other countries, then yes, their expectations have been less well anchored. And as I said earlier, I think that's partly driven by what's going on in their labour markets, which is a bit different to ours. Ours is tight, but our supply has responded and theirs hasn't. Other than that, I don't really... I would like to say it's just that we're really, really good at our messaging, but I don't think that's the reason. I do think, though, that what's been happening with wages overseas. And remember that in some of those countries, their inflation, you know, inflation in the UK and Europe is over 10%. It's much higher than here. You know, we're going to get to 8%, and that's pretty shocking. So it might just be that so far we haven't got up to the same levels. And the other thing is that, you know, there has been a certain amount of government assistance in rebates. Some of those things are going to roll off in December, which might come as a shock to people. So there's been a number of other things going on as well, which just might have helped to temper the inflationary expectations of households in particular. Yeah.
Thank you.
Michelle told me earlier she's an early riser, and I promised I'd get you out of here early. So these are going to be the last two questions. We'll get Tapas is having a second go, so it better be good, and then we'll go to Michael over here.
Thank you, Deputy Governor, and thank you for indulging my second question. And it goes back to a little bit in terms of what we're talking about in terms of my first question is really, what is the board's commitment to getting inflation back to target? And specifically, this is in reference to the even keel comments and the narrow path. Chairman Powell was asked these types of questions in his congressional and Senate testimony and saying he was willing to do a Paul Volcker in order to get inflation back to target. I get no sense that the RBA is willing to do a Volcker in order to get inflation to back to target, if that's required. Not saying it is, but are you able to say or give a little bit more guidance in terms of what the even keel comment actually means? Thank you.
Even keel. Sailing analogies aren't really my thing, but look, we are committed. We are very committed to get it back down to target, but we have a flexible inflation target, and we have a flexible inflation target for a reason. And in many ways, the easy solution might best be have a scorched earth. And yes, you could scorch the earth and get inflation back down very quickly. Is that the right thing to do, or is it better to try, as I said earlier, and preserve some of the gains while you bring it back down? Don't doubt our resolve that if we get some particularly bad news on inflation or wages look like, you know, all the reasons we think we might be different on wages, it turns out we're not, then don't doubt our resolve to increase interest rates quite quickly. We have increased, but I think people forget, we've already increased interest rates by 2.75 percentage points in 7 months. We've moved as quickly as others because we move every month. That's 40 basis points per month. And people say, oh, you know, supersize 75 basis points in 8 weeks. Sounds the same to me. So this idea that somehow we're being soft and we're not moving as quickly as others and we haven't got the resolve, I don't get that argument. Your point about the forecast meaning we're not back in target by the end of 2024, yes, that's right. But if we really thought we weren't going to get there at all, We'll move quicker.
Okay. Thank you, and that has helped clarify things. My only comment there would be if inflation isn't expected to get back to target until 2025, I think businesses and employees would be assuming higher inflation expectations in that environment. Thank you.
It's borderline speech, Tapas, right there. We'll go to Michael. Last question.
Yes, thank you, Deputy Governor. Michael Potter from the Financial Services Council. My question is following on from Rory's question earlier. So you've told us the bank has not made a submission to the review. I'm wondering if you could tell us why the bank has chosen not to make a submission to the review. Thank you.
We haven't made a submission to the review because I think we feel that it's appropriate that we provide all assistance to the review without actually putting our views formally into submission. I should say that we've actually provided them with a lot of information. They've asked us for a lot of information, a lot of data, they've asked us a lot of questions about our policy processes and so on, and we've answered all those questions. We just haven't put them into a submission specifically for the review committee. I should also add that we've had conversations with them. They have talked to all the board members. They have talked to some of the senior staff. They're doing a session for the staff where they're going to talk to the staff as well. And so although we haven't put in a submission, it doesn't mean we haven't actually provided some input to them.
That's it. Thanks, yep. Michelle. Thank you. Thanks again, Michelle. That's fantastic. Please thank Ms. Bullock again. Thank you.